Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
My deep belief is that it was not the refugee movement that triggered terrorism. I think, as I said, essentially terrorism in Europe is today a homegrown movement in relation to the global situation that we are facing. And what we need is exactly to prove these groups wrong by welcoming and integrating effectively those that are coming from that part of the world.
That was former Portuguese Prime Minister António Guterres. He spent 10 years as the UN's refugee chief. Now he's been picked to become the next Secretary General of the United Nations. Meanwhile, the refugees and migrants keep coming. Another wave of African migrants has attempted to cross the Mediterranean this week. More than 11,000 of them have been rescued by the Italian Coast Guard and aid groups. Many of them have been picked up stranded off the coast of Libya in dinghies and boats that are not equipped to make the crossing. Aris Macinas is a photographer with Agence France-Presse, and he's been on one of the rescue boats off the Libyan coast this week. His pictures appear today in the New York Times in a photo essay called Stepping Over the Dead on a Migrant Boat. And those photos are really astonishing. Aris Macinas joins us now from Tunisia. Welcome.
Hello. Good afternoon.
You have spent time on this rescue boat. Tell us about the pictures that you took and what you saw, and just try to describe it for the listeners who haven't seen these pictures.
This was one single boat out of dozens of boats arriving almost every day. It was like a daily normal rescue, but what we saw later was horrific, and it was so tragic moment what we faced. We start doing the rescue to disembark all these people from this fake dinghy to the safety boat of the Proactive Open Arms, a Spanish NGO that I embed with them. Mm-hmm. And when the dinghy start getting empty and more empty, we start facing the bodies, and all of us were shocked about this image. Mm-hmm. I jumped to the boat and I tried to capture this moment, you know, people that stepping on the dead to try to be rescued.
How did the people die who were on these boats?
What we realized from a doctor that it's also crew of Proactiva NGO is that there are two reasons, asphyxiation or they drowned inside the dinghy, because most of the times these dinghies are full of water because of the weather of the sea. Because when the weather is bad, the sea is not so calm, so it's full of water inside. And these people are so packed inside that there are people almost lying at the bottom of the dinghy.
Oh, my gosh. And there are people on top of them?
Of course, yes. Until the time we took the last group of refugees, because we could put in our Zodiac only 30 to 40 people maximum, also packed, but it's a better Zodiac. Until we took the last people, we could not see these bodies.
So it was a shock.
All these people were stepping on, of course. All these people were stepping on these bodies. They were telling us there are dead people in the boat, but we could not see them. When we almost emptied this dinghy, we start facing the dead bodies. And in the beginning, we saw they were telling us there were 10 people. When we emptied the boat, there were 22 people. But we knew that under these 22 were more. And when we finally took them and put them in body bags and tried to deliver these bodies to the authorities, we count 29 people, 10 men and 19 women.
29 people. And you also have pictures of children and babies. One baby
yes.
being handed
many babies
off
on this dinghy.
Many.
Many babies on this dinghy. Yeah.
And did they survive?
Hopefully from this one, yes. But there are many children drowning every day in the sea.
And these are refugees from where? From Ethiopia, Somalia, Nigeria?
We saw many nationalities. Ethiopia, Eritrea, mostly Somalia, Central African Republic, Congo, Nigeria. These are some nationalities I mentioned that we faced that day in these boats.
And they are trying to get to Italy? They're trying to get to Spain? Where are they trying
they
to get
are
to?
Trying, yes. The way now, the route is Italy.
Uh-huh.
They know they will never reach Italy with these boats. They know that they will, one time, they will run out of fuel in the middle of nowhere in the sea. They will just wait to be rescued. But after all these hours in the sea, first of all, you can die by, you can have a problem by water. You need water, you need food. If they don't be rescued immediately after 20 hours, they will start dying.
Hmm. So the smugglers know this?
The smugglers, the only thing they want to earn is money. They don't care about these people's lives. So they're doing their job. They take this money, they take the money from the people, which is just to know it's $2,000 each. Then after this, they let them sail. They show them one way, for example, they keep this direction and they let them go. And at the end, they are sailing for 20 nautical miles and they run out of fuel and they're just floating in the middle of nowhere.
So is there a conundrum on the part of the aid groups, the rescue boats, that they need to be out there to rescue people, but that they also know that they are also drawing people to make the voyage in the first place?
I don't know what could happen if all these rescue teams and all these were not in the area. I don't know. And I cannot see real action from the real authorities, military, NATO, or Coast Guard, or whatever.
Yeah. And then what happens when the people are rescued? Where do they go?
This is another part. Normally, the big NGO organizations, they have much bigger ships and boats, so they can collect many of them, and then they carry them to Italy, which is the destination. From them, it's the whole procedure that happens, registration, application for asylum, somebody has been accepted, somebody, some else not, and it's the story that we all know.
Yeah.
The point is, in the danger part of the journey is the sea. If we can avoid to risk all this, to lose all these lives, and we organize something safer for them, then we can continue all this procedure of the registration and the asylum. The point is how we can get rid, in a way, this part of the journey with these fake dinghies crossing the Mediterranean Sea.
Someone describes these ships, these dinghies, these boats, they're not ships, as the equivalent of modern-day slave ships.
Exactly. It's exactly this. But it's more sad. It makes me feel more sad because I'm not living in the mid-age or 800 years ago. I'm supposed to live in the 21st century in a civilized society. And when you face this kind of images, it's like you are living 300-400 years ago.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today, and thank you very much for your photographs.
Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for showing interest on this issue.
That's Aris Macinas. He's a photographer with Agence France-Presse. His pictures appear in today's New York Times in the article Stepping Over the Dead, on a Migrant Boat. I've tweeted out a link. My Twitter is @TheMadBrand. You should definitely check out those photos. Aris, thank you.
Thank you.
Tens of thousands of people have fled the drug wars in Mexico. They cross the border into the U.S. seeking safe harbor from the horrors of cartel violence. And once they got here, they thought they were safe. But in the mid-2000s, the drug war was spilling over the border into U.S. cities like Laredo, Texas. And so the cartels started recruiting American teenagers to become foot soldiers in that war. Bart Rada was 13 years old when he became an assassin. Gabriel Cardona was just a few years older when he was sent out to kill. Both worked for the Mexican paramilitary drug cartel known as the Zetas. The teen assassins of the Zeta cartel are the subject of journalist Dan Slater's new book. It's called Wolf Boys, Two American Teenagers and Mexico's Most Dangerous Drug Cartel. And when I spoke with Dan Slater earlier, I began by asking him about Gabriel Cardona and how a promising student ended up working for a violent drug cartel.
I think that when people saw the story of Gabriel in the news like I did, they might have imagined that all of a sudden he just became a drug cartel assassin when he was 16 or 17 years old. But in fact, it was a gradual slide. He actually started off life when he was a youngster as a fairly promising young guy. He was an award-winning student in middle school. He was the quarterback of his middle school football team. But then what happened is that he was benched on the team as a freshman and as a young man with a big ego. That was a big blow. He left the team, walked off the team, and didn't have anything to occupy his time after school anymore. And in a place like Laredo, Texas, that's a very dangerous place for a boy to be. And so it was in that time that he started getting involved in street gangs, which began with little drug smuggling, a little vehicle smuggling. And it was in that role that he met a man named Miguel Trevino, who in 2004 was sort of a mid-level boss in the Zetas. And it was Miguel who recruited Gabriel and then proceeded to recruit other youngsters from the United States to fight cartel wars, both in Mexico and then eventually across in the U.S. as well.
What was the appeal for Gabriel? What was he promised? And because, you know, he's American, and so if he got caught, at least on this side of the border, he could face some serious punishment.
Yes and no. He certainly faced serious punishment in the end, but he was arrested on homicides actually three times in the U.S., and he was interrogated by a homicide detective in Laredo named Robert Garcia, who's a character in the book. And he would go to jail, and he'd spend anywhere from a night to a couple months there. And then the Zetas would send an American lawyer with a bag of money to bail him out, and he would go right back to work. This happened several times in about 18 months. So through that, and also through his work for the cartel in Mexico, where there were not only no consequences, but the Mexican police often helped him actually carry out the crimes, he learned a culture of impunity. And so when he was finally brought down, I don't know if he really saw it coming or not. I think he did think it was going to last forever. As far as the incentives and what he got out of it, the obvious thing was money and the cars and the sexy women and all these sorts of things. But I think on some level, the sense of belonging and the sense of a purpose, which is what so many young men seek, especially at that age in Laredo, where boys tend to find themselves adrift at a much younger age, he actually saw a sense of purpose here and even saw a viable career path, as weird as that sounds.
That he thought he'd make his way up in the organization?
Absolutely. He thought that someday he was going to be running what they call a plaza in Mexico, that he'd be moved to Mexico, and whatever homicides and crimes he was on the hook for in the U.S. would no longer matter because he'd be off in some city like Cancun running the show with a cadre of his friends, and everything would be okay.
You describe how it's almost like an indoctrination, how he's first lured into the world there at the Zetas training camp. He and a bunch of other recruits, they are all wearing the same clothes, white T-shirts and blue jeans. And they're all told...
This was at the training camp.
Yeah, and they're all told to do pretty horrible things. Can you describe it within the bounds of we're listening to public radio?
Well, they're asked to do horrific things. And we see him become what he becomes through the instruction of the men running the camp. And from the perspective of the cartel bosses, the people who are overseeing all this, the purpose of it all is to weed out those who don't have it in their blood, those who don't have it in their genes to take a human life. They become the sicarios, just the word to describe assassins for the cartel. So, I'll say this. It was one of the hardest parts of the book for me to report, and probably the hardest part of the book to write, because it took me so long to kind of remove myself from the emotion of it.
Because they actually kill people. They round the organization, the Zetas, they round up a bunch of enemies. They call them Contras.
Right.
And who knows who these guys are. And they're basically the targets for these recruits.
They are used for live target practice and for other things. The purpose is to see if you can kill a live human being. And so they bring in, as you say, the Contras, the enemies, who in most cases are probably members of the rival cartel. But one of the things that we learn in the book, one of the things I learned when writing the book, is that not all the targets of the Zetas were necessarily working for the rivals. Sometimes it was just someone who ran afoul of the boss, maybe dated an ex-girlfriend or said the wrong thing to the wrong person. So the life is very precarious, and that was a lesson that Gabriel and Bart and the other Wolf Boys learned the hard way.
Are the Zetas more violent than the other cartels?
They're thought to be more violent than the other Mexican cartels. You often hear things like hyper-violent described to them. And I think that's probably true. I think that's probably deserved. Certainly one of the reasons for that is because unlike the other cartels, the Zetas truly originated with Mexican military. It would be the equivalent of like the Green Berets here in the U.S. all of a sudden deciding to become a criminal organization or a terrorist organization here at home. That's essentially what happened. So it started with a core group of elite Mexican military who were very highly trained and very efficient murderers. And those were the men who founded the cartel, and those were the men that ultimately trained these young men and boys who were recruited from the U.S. and elsewhere.
So why was it important for the Zetas to recruit American assassins? Because I'm sure they had a bunch in Mexico they could turn to.
Absolutely. I mean, there's obviously more Wolf Boys in Mexico than there are in the U.S. One of the reasons that American boys are so attracted to the cartel is because they can move back and forth across the border freely. And for instance, someone who was raised in Laredo, Texas, probably grows up going back and forth across the border very easily with their family on the weekends to see extended family in Mexico. They speak both languages fluently. They know the cultures on both sides. They can operate on both sides. And they come from a background of zero opportunity. So you dangle something like $10,000 in front of a 16 or 17-year-old, he's going to do pretty much whatever you ask him to do.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Dan Slater. His new book about the teenage assassins of the Zeta drug cartel is called Wolf Boys. You talk about the landscape, the political and economic landscape that has helped give rise to this moment in the early 2000s that you are writing about, and NAFTA comes up frequently. Explain that. How did NAFTA contribute to the rise of the Zetas and this sort of cross-border criminalization?
Well, NAFTA did a lot of things, but one of the main things it did vis-a-vis this story, vis-a-vis Wolf Boys, is that it transformed Laredo as a city, and it basically turned Laredo during the late 1990s into the largest overland port in the Western Hemisphere. Today, there are something like, on average, about 60,000 trucks move north every week This is a stone's throw from where Gabriel Cardona was raised. I mean, he could literally walk out of his childhood home, throw a stone across the river to Mexico, throw a stone to the International Bridge, throw a stone to the beginning of I-35, which is this prize smuggling, you know, corridor here in the U.S. And so this whole town became a gateway for a lot of commerce and a lot of illicit commerce, because when you have 60,000 trucks moving through a week, who's able to check all that? So smuggling became a lot easier post-NAFTA. NAFTA was enacted in 94. And so the years following NAFTA, smugglers learned that the risk of smuggling had just gone down a lot. If you talk to law enforcement agents on the border now, even the optimistic ones, the ones who are pretty pro-drug war, will say that at most we succeed with interdicting maybe 1% of everything that comes across.
So you mentioned how few of these trucks that cross the border carrying drugs are captured. And your other main character in your book, Robert Garcia, who is the detective who eventually brings down Gabriel, he used to work for the DEA, and he talks about his time there. And he tells you that he's deeply cynical now about the drug war. What was it that made him realize that this is maybe a futile war?
Well, I think for Robert, the turning point was getting the wide-angle national lens on what was happening. Robert is someone who started off as a Laredo street cop in the 90s when he was in his 20s. He had done that so well that when he turned 29, he was awarded Officer of the Year, and he became, for a brief period of time, a task force agent for the DEA. And then he was doing these national drug cases, national drug investigations. He would go undercover all over the country. He would follow a drug load from Texas up to New York, to Detroit, to Chicago, to San Diego. But what he saw during that time is even when he was working pretty well, he still was having zero impact on the flow of drugs. So when Robert returned to Laredo PD, he decided that, you know, in his words, the war on drugs was a big bleeping lie, and that he wanted to leave the drug investigations behind. So he became a homicide detective, and it was in that capacity that he pursued the Wolf Boys.
So is this still happening? Are these so-called Wolf Boys, as you call them, are they still operating in Laredo and elsewhere?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are Wolf Boys all over the country, both sides of the war, the Sinaloa cartel, the Zetas, the Gulf cartel. They have operatives as far north as Chicago and Montana, Boston, yes.
So there are a bunch of Gabriels out there.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Okay. I mean, this was the reason that I decided to write the book, because at first I wondered, are they an anomaly? I sort of hoped that they were. But then the more research I did in Mexico, the more research I did here in the U.S., the more people I spoke with, it became very clear that the drug war had nothing to do with the stories that we were reading about in the paper. It had nothing to do with the Chapo Guzmans and the cartel bosses. What it's about are young men and boys, these you know, little foot soldiers, fighting and slaughtering each other.
Well, Dan Slater, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Madeline. I appreciate it.
Dan Slater is an investigative journalist and author of the new book. It's called Wolf Boys, Two American Teenagers and Mexico's Most Dangerous Drug Cartel. And speaking about seeking out a better life, it might be harder for people to do that in Santa Monica if an anti-development ballot initiative passes next month. We'll tell you about it next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
The This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There's a battle raging over development in and around Los Angeles. On one side, people say we need to slow things down and stop the spread of high-rise and luxury buildings. The other side says we need more development to meet demand and stop housing prices from getting even higher. In Santa Monica, this fight is playing out over a ballot initiative called Measure LV, known as Measure Love. It would force nearly all new projects higher than two stories to pass a citywide vote. And joining me to discuss that, Phil Brock, a Santa Monica City Commissioner and longtime resident. He is for the measure. Welcome, Phil.
Good afternoon.
And Frank Gruber, a longtime resident and activist in Santa Monica who opposes it. Welcome to you, Frank.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, Phil, let's begin with you. What is driving this? Why do you think this is necessary?
Residents have gone through the last decade of trying to have the city council be responsive to many residents' concerns about the collective change going on in Santa Monica. Santa Monica was a beachside community, which means low-rise, beach-style dwellings and a comfortable lifestyle that's different from downtown Los Angeles. With recent development agreements and recent trends in Santa Monica, we're seeing the rise of mid-rise to high-rise developments. Those portend doom for the way of life that we've had in Santa Monica for 141 years. I think Santa Monica is best appreciated as a city that's different from downtown Los Angeles, different from LA. We want to see the difference when we cross the border into Santa Monica and our 8.4 million tourists, our 200,000 workers who come in the city every day, all want to see that difference as well.
Okay, so Frank, what's wrong with that? This idea that Santa Monica should be Santa Monica and not Los Angeles?
Well, I think we are Santa Monica, and we will be based upon the planning that's we will continue to be based on the planning that's gone forward for the last 11, 12 years. What this what LV is, it's the product of the people who were kind of left over on the extremes after the city went through a six-year project to update its general plan and then a five-year zoning ordinance. And during that time, you had the, by the way, everybody in Santa Monica in one way or another is slow growth. We have already slowed things down. When you cross the border, you immediately notice the difference in Santa Monica, and that's been going on for a long time. So you had the people who have various degrees of, more housing or less housing or whatever. But they basically all, after many compromises, agreed on a plan, a zoning ordinance that was passed in 2015. And a few people in Santa Monica politics, basically, who want really no more multifamily development in Santa Monica, they came up with LV. The reason why there's a kind of wall-to-wall coalition of Santa Monica organizations and political people against LV is that this is really an extreme element. And they're really kind of counterproductive in what they want to do. They'll end up getting a lot more, retail and office that generates more traffic than housing, which actually helps keep Santa Monica what it is. Santa Monica is 70% renter. It's never been this kind of idyllic suburban place that people say that it is. It used to have big industry here. Still has, that's part of our tradition. So, it's if you want to keep Santa Monica the way it is with a very diverse population that we've always had, then you have to build some more housing. And under the new planning, we have a very slow rollout of that.
Okay, Phil, let me ask you this. Santa Monica is already a very expensive place to live. I believe the median home price is about $1.2 million compared to L.A.'s around $600,000 for a median home price there. Wouldn't this make housing prices even more expensive because it would limit supply, limit growth?
Not passing LV would make housing prices more expensive. And to characterize the activists, the 10,000 people who have signed Measure LV's petition as extremists, that's one-ninth of the city's population. So I would not classify them as extremists. When you look at 301 Ocean Avenue at the northwest corner of our city, that apartment house is coming back online right now after being ellised in 5 or 6 years in limbo. The apartments are now being advertised at $10,000 per month for a one- or two-bedroom apartment. That's not helping decrease housing prices. On Fifth Street, the mixed-use developments that have been approved by the city council have not decreased housing prices. In fact, they're increasing housing prices, with apartments now going for $3,500 to $4,000 a month. So when you're looking at housing prices, passing LV will help decrease housing prices, or at least keep them the same in Santa Monica. If you keep adding more mixed-use developments that are five and six stories with extremely high-priced apartments, that puts pressure on the existing apartment rental units in Santa Monica and will cause them to have their rents go up. Above all, we should be working on the preservation of existing apartment units that are rent-controlled in our city. Yeah. Measure LV does not stop the production of housing. It allows housing to continue.
Okay, and Frank, I imagine you disagree with that. You think that there will be more affordable housing built.
Yeah, your instincts are absolutely correct, Madeline. If you don't build more housing, you restrict the supply, you're going to get increasing prices. Now, prices for housing increase for a lot of reasons. People want to live in Santa Monica. There's no question about it. But the reason that the developers in Santa Monica can make so much money from building their apartments is because we have a tremendous amount of jobs in Santa Monica, and for a long time didn't build any housing to go along with it. Now we're building housing at a modest rate, about 250 units a year. That's about 0.5% increase over. It's not an overwhelming amount of housing that we're building, but it does something. Plus, all the people who build this housing now in Santa Monica have to provide affordable housing along with it. We have an inclusionary housing policy to get this. Phil is really wrong. There's a when he says that LV won't stop housing production. LV will stop housing production because basically to build housing in Santa Monica, you have to go above 32 feet high. That's the way it is. Downtown,
why?
Because the economics of it are that if you can't build that housing, it makes more money to put up a box retail or a two- or three-story shared office building for all the tech companies, and they create more traffic than...
So isn't the question how many people can afford to live in Santa Monica, how many people do we want in Santa Monica, and how much of a mid-rise climate do we want in Santa Monica? And that comes to livability for existing residents of the city, as well as desirability for the future residents of Santa Monica.
Okay, Frank, I'll have you answer that really quickly because we're out of time.
Yeah, well, the planning documents in Santa Monica that were passed, it limit all this kind of new development to former commercial and industrial areas. They don't put it in the neighborhoods. They protect the neighborhoods.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Talking about Measure LV with Frank Gruber, who is against it, Phil Brock, who is for it. Thank you both very much.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, want to hear from you. What do you think of that? Is there too much development in Santa Monica? Not enough? Would you vote pro or con Measure LV? Let us know by voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the National Book Award finalists have been announced. We'll talk about the young adult nominees. And then our web mistress, Shani Jardin, talks about why Yahoo did a bad thing when it let the government search customers' emails.
If you leave your doors unlocked and federal agents are milling around drinking your coffee all day while you're gone at work, why do you care?
That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The shortlist for the National Book Awards was announced today. Pulitzer Prize winner and USC professor Viet Thanh Nguyen is among the finalists for nonfiction for his book Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War. Colson Whitehead, who spoke about his novel The Underground Railroad recently on our show, made the shortlist for fiction. Jacqueline Woodson is another finalist in the fiction category. Her novel is called Another Brooklyn, and she won the National Book Award in the Young People's Literature or Young Adult category 2 years ago. And that's a genre that has really exploded in popularity since it was first created by the National Book Foundation 20 years ago. A lot of books these days are incredibly violent and deal with adult issues. So what exactly is YA? Elliot Schrafer is a two-time National Book Award finalist, including for his YA book called Endangered back in 2012. And he was a judge for the awards last year, and he reviews children's books for USA Today. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. I'm just going to read the list here of the novelists who are nominated for in the YA category. Kate DiCamillo, John Lewis with Andrew Aden and Nate Powell for his memoir in a graphic novel form. Grace Lin, When the Sea Turned to Silver. Jason Reynolds, Ghosts. And Nicola Yoon for The Sun is Also a Star. Now, have these books been popular with young adults, with young adult readers, or are they critics' favorites, or both?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I came to writing young adult literature from adult literature. My first two books were actually for adults. And one of the things I noticed when I started writing for young adults was that the division between commercial and literary, which was so often a conversation topic in adult publishing, comes up much more rarely in young adult literature. Like books like The Fault in Our Stars by John Green, which was both a critical success and on many of the best of lists, and also a huge seller. So a lot of these are very popular books. Nicola Yoon's book that came out last year, Everything Everything, was a number one New York Times bestseller. So a lot of times that divide doesn't hold as strongly in young people's literature.
Right. So let's talk about the divide between young people's literature and people's literature, adult literature. Why is there a divide? Is it just because the protagonists are young?
Yes, it was actually something I experienced firsthand when I started writing Endangered. I wasn't sure initially what would be the difference from adult to young adult literature. And it's not really about content as far as, like, there's not certain topics that are off limits, but it's more that you have to really engage with the experience of what it means to be a teenager, in that you what it means to be coming of age. And so a lot of the emotions that we would write about with a more of a reserve in adult literature are just there throbbing on the surface when you're writing about young people. So it ends up being sometimes a much more heady read or just really has a lot of vitality and blood flowing in it.
Hmm. And as you say, they deal with really sometimes really serious issues in these books. We've got divorce, civil rights, racism, domestic violence, bullying, deportation. You know, these are serious topics. So is that something new, or has that been around forever when it comes to young adult fiction?
Yeah, it's interesting because young adult fiction has a number of enormous hits over the last decade, which can kind of eclipse the conversation if they're the only books you're talking about. So from Harry Potter, we segue into Twilight, and then Hunger Games, and then Divergent. And if you look just at those books and think that those summarize young adult literature, then it would seem to be a very high concept, action-y, very popular form. But these, you know, books that are much more quiet and literary have always been running alongside the other books in young adult literature. So it's hard to call it really a trend. If you looked at this award over the years, these books would not appear darker, I don't believe, than in previous years.
Well, speaking as an author, you're an adult, I assume, not a teenager. How do you capture the voice of a teenager and their concerns when you're not really living that life?
Yeah. You know, my experience of adulthood was kind of, I much prefer being an adult to being a teenager. I just remember everything feeling so raw when you're a teenager and, like, you're feeling it for the first time. So that first heartbreak is just so, so aching. And I think as adults, we sort of learn how to create distance from our own feelings, in that we don't the ones that aren't useful to us, we find ways to avoid the feeling it quite as deeply as we did when we were younger. And so in some ways, writing for young people was a great release for me as a writer, because you're writing about someone who doesn't have the defense strategies to sort of work around a tough situation, instead is heading right into it headlong. So it can be a really exciting situation to write about from a character's point of view, because it's not as moderated or mediated as it is in the adult world.
And when you're a judge, what are you looking for?
Well, you know, the National Book Foundation doesn't administer guidelines. It's up to each jury. So it's five people, and you know, you get together and you decide what your criteria are for what is greatness. And you know, as an author, it's a really great opportunity, because it's a year-long meditation on what makes a great book a masterpiece. Because you know, there's any number of books that could fit in this category of five out of the submissions, and so it's really figuring out what makes something truly magnificent instead of just very good.
You know, a lot of people have said there's a problem with diversity when it comes to YA books, but then looking at the list of these nominees for the finalists for the National Book Awards, it's pretty diverse. There are only a few, you know, white people on the list, and most of them are from ethnic minorities. So is that just because this is an awards list, or is there a different situation when it comes to the literature and diversity?
Well, there's a big push within children's literature to have more diverse books. And so there is more being published now than ever before featuring characters of color. And so it would make sense that they would be more represented in this list than in years past. So these are all really great books, and there is that resemblance between them. So it's hard to, you don't know what happens behind closed doors in the judging room, but these are certainly, you know, there's no books to sneeze at here either.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. That's Elliot Schrafer. He's a 2-time National Book Award finalist, including for his YA book. It's called Endangered.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Shani Jardin has been saying to us for a long time that we need to be good guardians, good stewards of our online privacy. Well, in recent news, Yahoo has been scanning every one of their emails on behalf of the government, and that just makes her case even stronger. Hi, Shani.
Auntie Shani tried to warn you.
Last week you were warning us.
Basically every week, it's just my
shtick. But
it was
too late, really, for the Yahoo people.
Oh, man. What
were they doing, exactly?
What a cluster cluck. So just after this terrible news that we were just talking about on Press Play, about how 500,000 user accounts were compromised in a security breach, we learned that there was a security breach of a different kind. So unlike companies like Twitter and Google, who have fought these so-called national security letters, these FISA court secret letters that demand that technology companies do one thing or another, kind of like when the government told Apple, you've got to help us hack the smartphone. So Yahoo got one of those, and it rolled right over and played dead. So the government said, we would like you to use the tools that you have available to search for all incidences of a certain phrase or a certain, we don't know exactly what they asked for, the details are a little murky, because nobody's talking to the press, they're just leaking little bits of information to the New York Times and to Reuters. But the government asked for some kind of either code or natural language phrase that indicated that messages were being sent back and forth through some terrorist network. So Yahoo did this, but the crazy thing about this isn't that they helped the government look for ISIS or whatever, but that they scanned all of our emails, all of our accounts, all of our metadata, that while we don't know the full scope of this yet because so much of it is still under wraps, they scanned a huge number of our accounts, maybe all accounts, for this phrase. And the funny thing, you know,
Do we know what that phrase was?
What we think is that there was one subset of a terrorist organization that was basically at the beginning of the email, it said, like, begin Mujahideen transmission.
No.
Yes. And
at Literally?
The end, it was like, end Mujahideen transmission. There's a lot of crazy details that are a little fuzzy and that are basically rumors flying around. But yeah, they were looking for a so-called computer signature tied to the communications of a state-sponsored terrorist organization. That's what these anonymous sources told the New York Times. Adding to the confusion is that Yahoo issued a very kind of sneaky response to all of this, saying the system that was described in the Reuters report, they broke the story, does not exist in our system. So that could mean, A, they nailed the description of what Yahoo was doing with the government, but it's no longer in the system. Or it could mean that Reuters failed to describe the scope of the operation accurately. And I'm going with the former.
Wow. Okay, so as a regular human who uses the internet,
I am so ready to give advice. I was born ready to give advice.
Well, let me just ask you this, though. Why should we care? Because if we're not...
Why should you
care?
Okay,
hang on. Because if I'm not putting begin Mujahideen transmission and end Mujahideen transmission.
If you're not part of a state-sponsored terrorist
organization. Why do I care if they're scanning for that particular phrase in my email and they see nothing and they move on?
Dude, if you leave your doors unlocked and federal agents are milling around drinking your coffee all day while you're gone at work, why do you care? You didn't have any
cocaine. So you're thinking that maybe they'll see some other stuff that'll say, oh, well, while we're here, why don't we check out this guy and what he's doing with his illegal pot farm or whatever.
Because principles. Wow. Yeah, look, I should also say that if you have a Tumblr account, so all you millennials listening, Tumblr, Flickr, the photo sharing service, which some of us still use, it's a great service, or any Yahoo Mail accounts or anything of the like, I recommend that you kill them with fire right now.
Okay, but what if you are a Yahoo Mail user?
Yes.
And that's like saying get rid of your email, and that's a lot. That's a big deal.
It's saying switch to a company that places your security and privacy over its profits.
Wait, is there one that does that, first of all?
Absolutely. I think anything but Yahoo at this point.
Okay.
Close your accounts.
Okay.
Flickr, Tumblr, Yahoo.
Okay,
done. And if you would like to argue with me on the internet about this, I am so ready, and I will be polite with you. So hit me up at Shani on Twitter.
Okay.
Argue with you all day.
All right. She's ready. Okay.
Yeah,
let's talk about Facebook and its error with Marketplace. It's got this thing. I guess it's trying to compete with what? Not Amazon, but it's got this marketplace where you can buy and sell stuff.
They're trying to compete with Silk Road and the
that's more like that, the dark web. People being people are selling unsavory stuff on the marketplace there on the Facebook.
Yeah. So one of my friends, Mike Montero, who's a designer up in the Bay Area, has had this campaign for months where he's trying to show people how widespread gun sales are on Facebook. People just kind of walking up to the farmer's market of guns. That basically existed on Facebook with, white guys in Georgia or California or Texas selling guns, but calling them, like code words like a milkshake or an American flag.
What else could you get on the marketplace?
Well, among the things that were sold, according to a New York Times article, illegal drugs, dogs, sexual services, baby hedgehogs, and guns.
There's only one thing I would get
that
list.
So,
and that's a baby hedgehog.
The product manager who introduced very cheerfully introduced the marketplace app in a blog post on Monday said that the a technical issue about how content was approved and sort of the process for pre-approval had caused, quote, certain posts with content that violated our policies to be visible to users. Facebook has a strong anti-hedgehog sales platform, and I'm really glad to see them enforcing that.
Okay, finally, let's talk about this Instagram account of a social media star named Louise Delage. There is no Louise Delage. This is a French hoax, and tell us about that.
So there was this funny story about a 25-year-old Parisian social media star, a beautiful young woman, one of the beauties of Instagram. She had something like 65,000 followers in just less than a month. Her cute, sexy selfies had simple captions like chilling with friends, dancing, little sexy, flirty stuff like that. And in each of these photos, she had a beer, she had a martini, she had a glass of wine, and to the uncritical eye, it looked like a young woman just having a good time on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, this was revealed to be an alcoholism awareness campaign. The idea that somebody could be suffering from alcoholism or addiction and you wouldn't know it. I frankly think that this campaign is just the dumbest thing ever, and it could only have come out of exactly where it did, which was a French advertising agency, BETC, and they had a campaign called Like My Addiction.
So basically they were trying to say even young, beautiful women can be alcoholics.
Hot white women can be alcoholics too, I think.
Is that
the
news?
No. By the way, if you're curious of how alcoholism works, did you know that you could go to open AA meetings and learn about this? You don't have to be you don't have to be part of a tricky ad agency's Instagram scam,
but
if
also,
you actually want to learn
yeah,
how it
but
works.
Also, wouldn't it backfire that it'll make it look more attractive to drink if you have an attractive woman drinking?
This is just stupid. This is yeah. Well, my next question is, like, of course that ad agency is that, like, they're going to go right back to work on a wine campaign. This is the kind of convoluted, stupid thing that only an ad agency that probably makes most of its billings from alcohol could come up with.
Jenny Jordan, thank you for all of your suggestions.
You're
all
welcome.
Good. I will take all of them, even the hedgehog one. Jenny Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net.
Thank you, Madeline.
And Julie Myers is here now. Hello there.
In the house. We talked about Measure LV, the Santa Monica measure that would put all development over two stories to a vote. Charles called in and he says that he supports Measure LV because when the city council approves huge developments, those developments are supposed to have affordable housing. And the so-called affordable housing isn't so affordable after all. So you just end up with these big behemoths that don't really do anything for the city. He says vote yes on LV. But Parker Kelly tweets that Santa Monica needs more housing at all. And if you put all development up for a vote, you're not going to get any new housing. No on LV. You may share your opinions as well. Twitter, Facebook, all the usual places.
Okay, great. Share it all. Thank you, Julie Myers. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.